And I, as an entrepreneur, I've been an entrepreneur for 20 years. I've never considered corporate nor government when I first start a venture. And it kind of brings me back to the idea of nature versus nurture. If you are born entrepreneur, or rather, if you're not an entrepreneur, can having a nurturing environment cause you to become an entrepreneur? So if I have, I don't know, corporate support, I have governmental support, I have a IPO and exit, does that make me want to necessarily become an entrepreneur? As a matter of fact, I think all of these initiatives are detrimental for the entrepreneurial system. You know why? Because you bring a lot of mercenaries. You don't bring entrepreneurs, you bring people who see opportunists. They see like, oh.
Taka Talks, exposing financial systems. One story.
Hello and assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Welcome everyone to another episode of Taka Talks. Today we have with us Ahmed Abdul Wahab. Ahmed is a seasoned entrepreneurial leader with over 20 years of international experience, currently serving as the founder and CEO of Next Arabia, a prominent advisory firm specializing in developing and operating impactful innovation ventures in the Middle East and beyond. He's held key roles in notable organizations, including as the head of Turn 8 Seed Accelerator and VC Fund in Dubai, which we were part of way back then, founding head of incubation at the Qatar Business Incubation Center, and founding manager for the Entrepreneurship Center at King Abdullah University of Science and Technology, KAUST, which we were also a part of recently. Ahmed's diverse background includes successful ventures in e-learning and intelligence startups, as well as strategic roles at Siemens AG, where he played a pivotal role in transforming operations from product-focused to solution and service-oriented in Saudi Arabia. Ahmed, welcome. That was the official bio. Tell us the unofficial bio.
the most important job is to be a son of my parents, alhamdulillah, husband of my wife, and father of our kids. So
best answer ever.
That is my priority number one. And so business-wise, as you might remember, I'm an entrepreneur. And if I just take a step back, I used to work for the German government, where I grew up in Germany, in economic development. And afterwards, did an executive MBA in Boston, back to Germany. I used to work for a big telecom company, which is Siemens, in the strategy division within the headquarters, and wanted always to go in the region. So went to Saudi to run Siemens Telecom, and which was amazing. And when Siemens Telecom was sold, I took a step back and said, what is actually the next big step? So being an intrapreneur, launching businesses for others, I said, I want to now be on the other side, be an entrepreneur. So I started the first company in Switzerland that beautifully failed because we did everything correct. What universities and teachers and incubators always tell us to do, which is whenever you have an idea, you first write a fiction book. Oh, sorry, I mean a business plan. It's like pretending you know the next 5 years what's going to happen. We did not even know that we're going to be together here a couple of weeks ago. So, but as entrepreneur, the first thing what people ask you is write this big business plan. So we did everything correctly, and maybe you can talk about in a minute. And that was the reason why we failed, because we have done everything what we're supposed to do. So the second time, we went into the US, and with no money in hand, we all of a sudden had two big ears and a small mouth. So we listened to customers. They really, really, really wanted. So based on that, we signed contracts, and without developing any product. And then we sold the company, and took a little bit of time with my family in Finland, and then back in the Middle East, as KAUST, as you said, we're focused on academics and research, but then there was no entrepreneurship. So connected with KAUST, said, hey, why don't we just do entrepreneurship that would really add value to the academic research in order to spin off companies, et cetera. So that we had the opportunity to work and to develop and launch the Entrepreneurship Center. And after 2 years, we won an award for being the best center in the Arab world as part of the World Entrepreneurship Summit. And Qatar connected with me and said, hey, we want to develop the biggest incubator in the Arab world. So I asked my boss what she thinks about, which is my wife. She said, yes, let's go to Qatar. And so we went to Qatar. We launched in the Qatar Business Incubation Center. And 7 years ago, finally, we moved to Dubai, where my bosses, which is my wife and the kids, they're happy, alhamdulillah. We launched in Next Arabia, which is, as you mentioned, advisory, a boutique advisory firm, where we advise big corporates, government entities, and universities in launching innovative new ventures. So it's not incubator or accelerator, but really something impactful. Or in other words, what I call it, no kumbaya, but creating real value and impact.
Fantastic. I have a question from your introduction, actually. You mentioned that, you know, there weren't that many entrepreneurs in Saudi Arabia and the MENA region in general way back when. So what do you think is the reasons for that? Why is it there are so many entrepreneurs in a place like America? And why are there so few entrepreneurs in somewhere like the Middle East, the Gulf particularly? And perhaps maybe touch on Africa as well.
We'll be right back after the break.
Techa Talks brings you stories from around the world that will help you understand how crypto and Islamic finance can change our lives for the better. Subscribe and follow us to keep learning in Africa as well.
So one thing we also have to put things into the right context. So the entrepreneurship in Europe and especially in North America and US, it really didn't come within 10 years or 20 years. It took way longer time. It took 30, 40 years time to actually evolve. If you look, for example, Silicon Valley, people say, hey, let's create our own Silicon Valley, our own Silicon Saudi Valley or UAE Valley. Is that going to work? Because it needs some time. It needs some time. So if we say we want to replicate very quickly everything in 5 years or 10 years, it's not going to work unless it's artificial. It has to work in an organic, of course, pushing, but on an organic way. So what has been changed in, for example, in Saudi, as you mentioned, Saudi 10 years ago, now it's 2024, even let's say 12 years ago, when we really started 12 and a half years ago in 2011, where entrepreneurship at that time it was like, oh, you want to start a company? Couldn't you find a job in the government? That was literally the answer in Saudi at that time. When somebody said, I want to start a company, 2011, you couldn't find a job in the government or at Aramco or at SABIC, etc. So things now completely changed. It really, really changed. Are we there yet? Absolutely no. Absolutely no. Because the good thing is the government pushes entrepreneurship with funding and accelerators and incubators. Yes, that's a great, great push. But is it sustainable and organic? I would say not yet. Yeah, it's a big, big push, but it has to become mature so that it really runs smoothly by itself. And that will take longer time. It's just a question of maturity where then the ecosystem really works together, which they really don't work completely as it's in a mature place. And when I say the ecosystem, it is the universities, specifically universities. You have the universities, you have the incubators, you have the accelerators, you have the venture capital companies, etc. So, and especially the corporates, they're playing a very, very critical role. The government is pushing. Is it in a coordinated way? I'm not sure. Universities, over the last, let's say, 3 to 4 years, realized they need to do more commercialization. Because in their world, startups, they don't understand, but you see commercialization and they understand it. So commercializing IP technology through spin-offs. So when we work with university, we use spin-off instead of create, saying startup companies, because for them, startup companies associated with little kids, their students, they're just playing around and do some things. But in the university where they invested huge in IP and technology, it's more commercialization and really spin-off. So the university understand they have to do more job creation through spin-off and startup. But it has to be more coordinated with incubators and accelerators. Same thing with corporates. Corporates need to be more engaged with, not engaged, they should leverage more startups, many of the corporates, if not most of them, are still doing what I call innovation theater. Just say, yeah, we work with startups, et cetera, as a CSR or marketing, but it's not really to solve their pain point. It's not really to solve their real pain point. It's getting better now, but are we there yet? Definitely not there. So there's a lot of things still that needs to be done in order to smoothly align the ecosystem. But I believe we are on a very good track so far.
Actually, I want to add up on that, Ahmed. So basically, you know, when we were back then in Dubai, I think it was in 2017, something like that, 16, 17, we had this push from the ecosystem and the Dubai authorities, UAE authorities, to really create, you know, copycat of the Silicon Valley. And the Dubai Silicon Oasis and all these kind of things, a lot of things. But they were doing a good job, but somehow there were so many things missing. And for me, they were like, for example, a lot of announcements, and but they were not following up yes. on the announcements that they were promising. That's one of the things that was. The other thing is that UAE was like 90%, maybe 95% of expat, okay? Where, you know, it's very difficult for somebody who doesn't belong to a place to look to try to build an economy, you know, in 4 years of being just a transit, I would say transit citizen. And then as you mentioned, the UAE local population, they were pampered, and they're still pampered with a very fat salary where they don't want and they don't have an incentive to actually join a startup because they have a huge pay cut in order for them to come and join a startup. When I landed to Saudi Arabia, and it was a total different story, to be honest. And I remember also this time when you were there in Saudi Arabia as well, when they were really at the beginning. So I had two experiences in Saudi Arabia. The first time when I launched my first startup and I was in UAE to launch it, and I came back to Saudi, the ecosystem was like non-existent.
Yeah.
There were very few entrepreneurs. And that was a time when you were there. Fast forward 5 years, when I came back, it was a total different game. First of all, as you mentioned, you need a whole entire ecosystem around it to make it happen.
Yes.
You need a very great support from the government and the private sector, the university, and so on and so forth. What was amazing and what they have been achieving in the past 5 years, I would say that I am here, it's phenomenal. Yes. First of all, the incentive for the Saudi to start up a company, it's more attractive than even joining private or, you know, a public company, because, you know, you might still have a pay cut, but still the salary can get you going reasonably in Saudi Arabia because the cost of living is much cheaper. And of course, you know, you're not, you know, you're capitalizing on your equity, not on the salary that you're going to make. Second of all, when the government really walk the talk,
yeah,
they created multiple founder funds and starting really supporting a local ecosystem and VC. Okay. They push the corporate enterprise and the family offices and stuff like that to also be part of that ecosystem. And what is also super, super, super amazing is the pool of talent of the Saudi talent coming back to Saudi Arabia.
Yeah.
Many of them, they were holding top jobs in Silicon Valley, all over the world, coming back to the country, building the country and the ecosystem. And last but not least, the angel network ecosystem. Because without the first check, nothing can happen. And now Saudi Arabia, I wouldn't say that they are close to the Silicon Valley ecosystem. There's still a long way to go. But they have been really able to create the entire 360 ecosystem that makes them unique. And you see now even American startup relocating in Saudi Arabia, not only for Saudi Arabia, but for the entire greater region.
Yeah.
And the talent pool is actually expanding.
Yeah.
Because again, Saudi Arabia has the youngest population. The majority of the Saudis are under 25 years old. Okay. And also the talent pool is becoming more and more accessible and available in Saudi Arabia.
Yeah.
Okay. So this is a different, yeah. Yeah.
If I had two comments on it, number one, it is really attractive for a startup now to start in Saudi. My next thing is to think about what can we do in Saudi to make it really sustainable? Because the way that the number of investments and amount is not sustainable over a long period of time. Because what's going in, it's good funding, but we need to ensure that at some point, these investments go into the startups that are really worth. And I understand over the last couple of years, because Saudi had to a lot of catch up, if you just look in compared to the UAE, more investments to be done. But if we then see all this investment has been done, how many will be actually surviving? That's a question we're going to see, for example, this year in 2024. Those who got funding in 2022 and 2023, how many of them actually will survive? So what we need to do is making sure that there are more smart funding. So investing in the right, really, startups in order to make it really sustainable. And the second is the corporates, they're playing a very critical role in order to give the startups a chance. And the corporates changed over the last couple of years, absolutely. But there's a lot of things that the corporates can do in order to integrate really more with the startup world. And on the talent side, you're completely correct. There is such an amazing pool of talents in Saudi. Amazing pool. However, there is a lot of talents that are brought from outside the country still. Still significant amount of talents abroad. So we started, for example, an initiative here in the UAE in order to develop local talents so that we reduce the amount of foreign talents to come over here. In other words, we have a lot of, it's similar to Saudi, a lot of graduates that really has an amazing theoretical academics background. But in order to turn them into talents, they need kind of an internship, kind of practical experience. So what would be really great that we need in Saudi would be that kind of transformation from those who are graduating, for example, providing them the right mentorship, internship, apprenticeship, etc., to turn them into real talents, into talents, so they can become feeder for the startups, but also for the corporates. I'll give a specific example. We have thousands of graduates in machine learning in Saudi or cybersecurity, but they have just theoretical knowledge, which is limited value for the startups and as well for corporates. But if they would get internships, apprenticeship, etc., that little tick would significantly add value to their skill sets, practical skill sets. And that would make them much more attractive for startups. And for startups, these are the specific talents that they really need, specifically the one that are growing, that receive initial funding, that have the funding to hire people.
On the funding side, you're totally right, Ahmed. There's a lot of cash going into startup. And what you want to hear is, are they able to tackle the right problem? And are they able to scale beyond Saudi Arabia? And because, the most biggest worry for investors is what is, quote unquote, the exit strategy and what's happening next. Alhamdulillah, again, Saudi Arabia has been very creative. And they created actually this secondary market called Numu. And they had made, like, for example, Jazz becoming one of the unicorn that not only succeeded in the local market, but outside and behind the market. Okay, so you see now that the investment actually find a potential IPO locally, okay, and things are happening. So they have also a program going on with, you know, they call it the unicorn program, and you see startup the like of Kitopi, Classera becoming global unicorn. You know, they are not only succeeding in Saudi Arabia, they are also able to succeed outside of Saudi Arabia and finding also a potential way to again go into a secondary IPO locally. The like of what Aramco did, you know, they did a local IPO and they succeeded. So again, it's interesting that you mentioned that, but they were very reactive in being able to do something that UAE didn't even think about and were not able to do that with their own local market there. You see, there's a big difference in terms of the where you know, things are standing now. And most of the founders I'm talking to now, most of them are pre-IPO. A lot of companies are going to be applying in the next 2, 3, 4, 5 years IPO locally. Into Nomu, as I mentioned. So it's very exciting time for investors and founders because there is a way to finally exit.
Yeah.
I sort of want to jump in here and introduce to you guys the voice of the
We'll be right back after the break.
We believe that the financial system is broken and that our banks and insurance companies don't have our best interests at heart. We've built Techaturn to help us get together as a community to save, earn, and access credit. Join us today and discover how you can grow your savings while helping others. Entrepreneur here. Because you are talking about corporates, you're talking about governments. And I, as an entrepreneur, I've been an entrepreneur for 20 years. I've never considered corporate nor government when I first start a venture. And it kind of brings me back to the idea of nature versus nurture. If you are a born entrepreneur, or rather, if you're not an entrepreneur, can having a nurturing environment cause you to become an entrepreneur? So if I have, I don't know, corporate support, I have governmental support, I have a IPO and exit, does that make me want to necessarily become an entrepreneur? As a matter of fact, I think all of these initiatives are detrimental for the entrepreneurial system. You know why? Because you bring a lot of mercenaries. You don't bring entrepreneurs, you bring people who see opportunists. They see like, oh, it's easy to raise money, it's easy to exit. But the reality, and this is why it's not sustainable, is it's not that easy. And when you get, when you come up against a road bump and you're not an actual hardcore entrepreneur, you're going to give up. And that's why these things, I think, don't flourish. And I'm not really sure all these making it super, super easy, flushing the market with cash really will build an organic system, as you had said.
That's actually a very good point. That's what I mentioned with, is this sustainable? Is this sustainable? And if I break down your question into two pieces, it's what do we need for startups and what do we need for scale-ups? What happened over the last couple of, let's say, 10 years, the first part of the 10 years was heavily focusing on startups. Now, it's still heavily focused on startups, but also now putting more additional efforts into the scale-ups, which is great. Which is really developing kind of unicorns, et cetera, as Murad said. If you look at who actually brings economic impact, it's not the startups, it's the scale-ups. The scale-ups are the one who creates jobs, revenues, and contribute directly or indirectly to the GDP. It's not the startups, because we need to make sure that we just don't start companies, but we help them to really grow. Grow is the actual objective. Starting point is a necessary part in order to grow later on. If we do come up to your question, in the beginning, we need to do some pampering, yes, for the startups, especially in our region. We really need to do that because there's a lot of that need to catch up. In the Western world, thing that they already had for the last 30, 40 years or 50 years, we just didn't have it. We just started. Remember 10 years ago, when you said I started a company or 12 years ago, people literally thought in Saudi, you couldn't find a job in a government entity. So it was something really negative, really, really negative news. Today is something positive. However, there is a fine line of over-pampering, and you're completely correct. If you organize everything for them, then the drive is not there anymore. The hunger, the fire in the eyes is not there anymore. You're right. If we compare, for example, Saudi and the UAE, Saudi, they have absolutely more hunger to start businesses, way more than in the UAE. Just looking at the expats versus Emirates, if I just focus on Emiratis and over there. So there is no one way to make it correct. Saudi needs a different approach than in the UAE. But I agree with you, too much pampering makes no sense, because then you take off the hard work of them. But to be fair again, we need to catch up to the Western world, so we need the kind of support system, and specifically outside the main cities. Unfortunately, the major support cities, the support areas are in Riyadh, Dammam, and Riyadh, Jeddah, and Dammam, Khobar area. But what I'm talking about is really in the region. And the actual talents are in the region, not in the main cities. They're actually somewhere in the village and sits in the computer, and they're very much skilled. Very much skilled. And that's the thing that hopefully will change in Saudi, to put more emphasis into the region rather than just the three major metropolitan cities.
Very cool. So I know you've had you recently launched an initiative with MasterCard in Kenya. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. So one is a startup. As an entrepreneur, it's just when I go somewhere, you see an opportunity and you just launch it. But the other one is a social initiative where we see so many youth that are just unemployed and underemployed. These are two things, unemployment and underemployment. Underemployment means they graduated somewhere, but then they end up in being an Uber driver, etc. That's a real big issue, not just in Kenya, but throughout the developing countries, that the youth are unemployed and underemployed. And then on the other hand, we see that the industry, they have real pain points out there that they cannot solve. And we said, why don't we match them both and look at, in order to help the youth to find dignified work and entrepreneurship opportunities, instead of just developing and training, and then at the end, so that just don't find jobs, or just few of them find jobs, we do the other way around, like in a startup, in a lean startup methodology, where we do first customer validation before we develop the product. So all the academic institutions, what they do is they're doing the old fashioned, which is developing the fiction book, a business plan, and just to figure out there's no market. Same as is in the development of youth. So they do training, just to figure out there are no jobs. So we do the other way around. We said, let's focus on jobs. What specific pain points are in the that have the industry have? And then we spoke with several industries, and we identified industry partner that have real pain points and want to hire people either as employees or, which would be better, suppliers, as suppliers, which means startup opportunities for the youth. So we picked this up, and then these specific pain points, we listed them down, and then we went to universities and the TVETs. TVETs is the technical and vocational institutions, to promote these pain points, not challenges again. It's not challenges like kumbaya, we have a challenge, etc. Well, nothing happens. Real pain points where they have a need. They want to hire somebody, not in 1 month, 3-4 months. They want to hire now. So going in the universities and figuring out what talents are out there, and then they apply, which they did, and then we match them with the pain points, and now we take them through a training and coaching and industry engagement sessions in order to, number one, teach them how the real world works from a business perspective, how to deal with industry. Because if you take young people, similar to startups, if you take an entrepreneur and you bring them to STC or Aramco, they're never going to understand each other. They're going to talk two different languages, etc. So we train them from a business perspective and how to deal with them, etc. And then we coach them one-on-one before they go to a meeting. And then they go to the industry, they meet with them, validate their pain points, and then they develop prototype solutions to solve their pain points. And they're right now. And then by the end of the month, inshallah, or early next month, inshallah, we will have a deal day where then the industry sign real contracts to hire them either as an employee or as a supplier, which means that they're going to launch startup business and generate revenues from them. Because if they solve that pain point for that one company, guess what? All other companies in the same industry have the same pain point. So the scalability.
Mm-hmm. So tell us some of the pain points that were identified through this process.
So without naming the companies, it's heavily IT driven. Specifically, it's prediction, AI, developing AI prediction model, for example, for the large super chain market, a super chain where they want to figure out what will be from the supply chain, supply side, the predictions that, so that they can plan ahead of time with the suppliers, and at the same time as well, that they can plan better revenue projection, figuring out when the consumers will buy the stuff, etc. These are some of the pain points. Or another pain point is developing business model for water tank company. It's an existing scale up. The 2 years ago they were startup, but it's a startup, but they generated a good amount of revenues already, and they want to further scale. So their key challenge is how to significantly scale way faster than the market. Some ways is the team that they're developing on is a water tank. Is, for example, you add some few features that make them more valuable, such as you put a sensor that will say, soon you have 10% left of your water and your water tank, 10% or 20%. So you know when to order. It orders automatically with the supplier, so that makes the life of the consumer easier. Or other sensors that you can see the water quality, etc. So if that company leverages these kind of features, they will generate, inshallah, more revenues, because they would have value add that the consumers want in order then to buy more. So how do they do? They went to consumers, they went on and said, and for example, in the water tank, what do you actually need in order to, when you buy the water tank, what is the most important elements for you? So the features is one side, the other part is the distribution, the delivery, etc. These kind of things. Other pain point is social market, digital marketing. How to significantly improve? You're going to hire digital marketing team, etc. So these are some of the pain points.
Question: Since you have this, they say traveling kind of build up a personality and help you create a new self, I would say. You've been traveling between Kenya, UAE now a lot.
And Saudi.
And Saudi as well, yeah. And you see, and I want to see, I know that, there's a lot of buzz around payment. And you come from the land of M-Pesa being the easiest way to send money and to actually, quote unquote, have no need for a bank account anymore because the M-Pesa account can cover everything else. So being surrounded by this type of mentality of young Kenyan, being able to use technology to transfer money faster than anywhere else in the world within their own local market. Then you travel and you go back to UAE and you hear about this crypto wallet or exchanges that are opening up. The latest one is M2 from Abu Dhabi. So what do you see among the young people, and what do you see in this technology and the easiest way to help them being, I would say, financially inclusive into the system? What do you see from this population and where you come from on both hands?
Yeah. So when I went there, it's just amazing to see. Really amazing to see the payment aspect. M-Pesa, 80% of all financial transactions go via M-Pesa, no bank. Most people don't actually have a bank account. And then some people say, oh, there's a great opportunity because they're unbanked. Yeah, they have M-Pesa, they don't need a bank. Unless you consider M-Pesa as a bank. The point here is when you get used to these kind of things like M-Pesa, and I get used to it. Last time I forgot my wallet in Dubai and I needed to pay something, and I just picked up my phone and was not able to pay. I said, oh, I can't pay with M-Pesa. So there is we are literally lacking behind. In that sense, we are really lacking behind when it comes to payments. The cryptocurrencies or the tokenization, etc., this will come. It's Netsa, what you guys are doing is just something really, really amazing. It is amazing. And it will come. It's just a question of how fast it will be. And in a few years, we probably will be regretting that we should have invested more in it. My personal stake is if we can connect the digital assets, if we can connect the tokenization to something valuable attached, for example, into commodities, so real estate, commodities, physical goods, etc., this will come very, very quick. And it will have actually significant value. I give you a specific example in the agriculture. Agriculture, if you take something from Kenya and then Uganda, Tanzania, and then to Saudi, etc., if you buy something to another country, there's a lot of loss in currency from the local currency into dollar and then another local currency into another dollar and a local currency, another dollar. But if you introduce a particular coin for avocado or something else, that will be your currency. There's no more currency risk that goes up and down and etc. There won't be any of it. Number one, it's going to be instant. You can literally have it. And number three is you have real value. There's an underlying value to it, not something where there's no value beneath it, but there's something really underlying value. And for me, this is even better, more worth than having a US dollar or a shilling or whatever currency, because each of the US dollar or shilling or currency, they have no underlying value. There's no underlying value. It's just a paper. We are just brainwashed that it's a $10 value or 10 dirham value. Because that was 80s years ago where that's the underlying value. Today, it's just a paper, but we all accept that and we imagine that it's $10 value. You see what I mean?
I totally agree with you. And when I look at Africa and I think about my own experience, one of the biggest impediments to entrepreneurs and startups in general is the financial system. I think about, okay, me and Murad, we have, you know, some, family in Algeria. We have opportunities there, right? But every time they say, you know, go do business in Algeria, I'm like, okay, or buy property in Algeria. I'm like, okay, I buy something. And then the value of the dinar goes down. So even though the nominal value, the property has gone up in price, for example, but the value of the dinar has gone down. So my investment has lost money. So why would anybody invest? And I think how can, for investors, want to invest in startups there? And I think a lot of startups have this problem. It's like they may be increasing their revenues, but in real value, because of the depreciation of the currency, they're not making money. They're losing money. And the investor, as a result, has lost money. So this has to be solved before there can be any true entrepreneurship, any true innovation. And Africa is, I think, a huge untapped opportunity just from population growth alone. Young people everywhere, right? You cannot go wrong with that kind of population dynamics.
If you look at this Kenya, I'm not marketing for Kenya whatsoever, by the way. 55.
By the way, our podcast producer, Joseph, is from Kenya, is listening right now. So you can go ahead and market for Kenya.
MashaAllah. So 55 million people, 55 million. Take the all GCC together. Kenya has a bigger population, whole GCC. If you take the whole East African community, 350 million people. That's East African community, 350 million people. That is a market that is significantly coming up, significantly. And with the opportunities and then with projects such as, for example, what you're doing, when it comes to our overall cryptocurrency, specifically in the agriculture sector, at the mining sector, that will have a significant impact. And it will come. It will come.
I like the avocado coin. I think that that's something you should really, I would say, mark on you, on you. Keep it for yourself, because that's something that could really come up very soon, inshallah. Yeah, as you mentioned, yeah, the tokenization of asset, tokenization of real asset, definitely the farming industry needs more, especially technology, blockchain technology, and of course, tokenization of their own farming asset as well. It's something really happening, you know, it's happening very fast, actually. And we believe that, you know, this... those nations who are suffering the most with the devaluation of their own currency, local currency, will be the one to, again, catch up and leapfrog, you know. So we see now Nigeria, for example, has been banning crypto for some time now. It's back on the table. And you see South Africa signing bills regarding cryptocurrency. Kenya also is looking at some alternative ways. I think M-Pesa tried to integrate some of off-ramping, on-ramping of crypto payment as well, because of the high level of cross-border payment and also the freelancers' economy. Most of them are getting paid in crypto. So that's one of the ways to avoid paying high fees when it comes to regular exchanges like Western Union and so on and so forth. But yeah, so that's great that we have this institution. So what do you see, I mean, in overall technology-wise, you know, beside the, you know, crypto and the Web3 technology, what do you see the future of Africa, actually? We know that they move from nothing to the mobile. And now, you know, we believe that they're in a very good position to be the one leading again the race when it comes to technology and blockchain, AI. What do you see in comparison to the Middle East?
So... in the Middle East, there is the know-how, but if we look at the market, just pure market size, where things happening, it's literally areas such as Africa, Latin America, and Asia over there. So what I'm saying is, if we just focus on Middle East and Africa, the thing of M-Pesa is just the first major thing. Remember when M-Pesa started 15 years ago, people were just using banks and just cash. And within 10 years, they took over 80% of the world financial market. So 80% of the financial transaction go via M-Pesa. If you take the valuation, the owner of M-Pesa is Safaricom, which is the local PTT. So the STC or Etisalat in Kenya is called Safaricom. That owns M-Pesa, it's a department of M-Pesa, a department of Safaricom, sorry. If you look at the valuation of the next 10 banks, Safaricom has a higher valuation than the next 10 banks combined. That is really significant.
Without having a banking license, I suppose.
Exactly, without having a banking license. And that's one of the reasons why it's not spin-off, I believe, and create an own company. Because the more they create their own company, then they have to get. And guess what? 100% at some point they will do it. They cannot, they will be under pressure, not locally, but internationally. Because locally it's a government company. Government owns. Government and as well private. Vodafone owns share. So it's not something secret. You can look it up in the on the website. So this is just the first step. The next step is once in Africa, the major industries is really agriculture, mining, and so these are the industries. The moment somebody comes up with the next M-Pesa for the agriculture and the mining, that's going to be the next big thing. And the way to leverage Middle East and Africa would be taking the knowledge, the ideas, the innovations from the Middle East, and then applying it over there in the market. That would be a good way of really combining, because the market is just a vast. The market is in Africa, and we have a lot of innovations and inventions done in the Middle East with limited market impact. So I think, or maybe after this podcast, you and I, we discuss how we can make the AgriCoin actually happen. That's something that's going to be the next big thing. I guarantee you, somebody will come up with that. Instead of, let's replace the word somebody with us after this podcast.
You know, I was going to tell you, most of the resources, global resources, you name it, from what is dig on the ground, I mean, store on the ground, and what is on top of the ground. You know, I remember calling a friend of mine in the Netherlands, and they had the most beautiful plants in the world, selling the Netherlands are the largest suppliers of indoor plants, outdoor plants, you name it.
Yeah.
And 40-60% of the supply come from Africa.
Yes.
Especially flowers that are even cut flower, they call it.
Especially from Kenya. There are two planes every day going directly to
Netherlands. It's crazy. So I was like, you know, they always talk about European, always talking about fair trades and, you know, paying the right amount of cash to the farmers. You're talking about even coffee growers and getting the fair trades and all this kind. But in reality, Europeans are taking advantage massively in undercutting and paying the less possible to the African nations. You have a great example of the French, for example, paying the uranium at a cent a kilo when it comes to the Mali. That's why they had some issue with the Mali kicking them out, because they were paying almost nothing to buy uranium, which was quote-unquote... the real value was like around $200 or even more a kilo. And they were paying a cent over that uranium. So we were talking with friends and stuff like that. One way to really solve this problem is to tokenize those real assets and find a real market where people can, because most of the time the Europeans are the ones supplying the fund in order to extract or to do some kind of the work. And hence, they tied up, the buying process with an exclusive buying process when it comes to, to buying. And they don't allow you to sell in the market. Can you imagine that even the Burkina Faso gold, for example, the Burkina Faso government was obliged to sell its gold at a discount to the French government. And the French government has more gold than Burkina Faso, who is the supplier and producer of gold. You know, so it's kind of funny, and they were paying a big discount on the gold. So yeah, I think there's definitely a way to use technology to help the local producer get access to funds in the decentralized manners, or peer to peer manners, crowdfunding manners, to get the proper cash in order for them to develop the industry and tokenize this asset and sell it at a fair market price to the global world, not anymore with a certain, I would say, country that take advantage of the system, I would say. What do you think about...
Exactly. And if I just add to it, that way, it's going to be collateralized assets with real assets. So that token, there's a real collateral, which is in this coin, gold or even avocados or any kind of material. It's high liquidity. So it's high liquidity that different players in the value chain can actually buy it. The distributor, the retailer, etc. Is high liquidity. And the from a pricing perspective, is a relatively stable price. If you go through cross border, it's a very stable price in compared to the traditional way how it's right now when they need to convert it into the US dollar and others. So while it's everything, most things still US driven, and now there's another block coming up with when they say we're going to use euro or yen or etc. At the end, they will come to the cryptocurrency. They will that will be the underlying currency that everybody at the end of the day will accept it. So right now, as you know, few countries are accepting cryptocurrency, but the real impact will be, if not individual countries, but rather blocks accept it. Yeah, the moment some blocks accept it, for example, like the East African community or the Southern community in Africa or in Europe, Asia or Latin America. So not just one country, but really a block of countries, because then we would actually see the volume. Because within one country, we see just a limited impact. And it has, if you look at just country-wise, it really has a limited impact. But the real impact, the larger, is once it's cross borders. Yeah, then we see the real impact. And it will come. It will come. It's just a question of when. For entrepreneurs, it does not mean we wait until it's out there. For entrepreneurs, is how can we make it actually happen?
Excellent. So this is a business in the making. All right. So
we have a one-on-one session.
There you go. So to wrap up, tell us what's next for Next Arabia, and how can people reach out to you if they would like to speak to you more?
Yeah. So if I just take a step back, why we call it Next Arabia, it's always about the next, not just the current, but always about the next. So from an entrepreneurship startup area, is we're working with several startup companies that are really looking forward to move from a scale up into a global company. That means not just doing business in Saudi, here in the Middle East, but really scaling up into the Western Europe or Asian, further Asian world. These are the things that we are working on. When it comes to corporates, those who are really interested in transforming. When I say transforming, is for example, we work with banks that move from a bank into banking, not just bank anymore. So if you are a large company and really understand the value of technology, and you want to move, in this example, from a bank to banking, what it means is instead of offering a loan and savings, we helped create marketplace where their offering is just part of many other offerings. So instead of fighting against the fintechs and fighting against the tech fins are the large tech companies that enter into the financial service like Amazon's, the Google's, Alibaba's, etc. These are tech fins. So corporates that are, instead of fighting the fintech and tech fins, create your own, because you have still the market. Next 5 years, things will look different. People won't go to the bank anymore, but they're going to do banking. So better leverage it. And from a government perspective, what we do there is 10x, helping them to developing complete new business models in order to significantly improve their services. And the fourth element is the universities. Universities are focused on creating the next big thing. Personally, I don't think the incubators like Accelerus, we're going to create the next big thing, but rather it's going to be a research-driven university that already invested heavily in IP and technology, but just don't have no idea how to really spin it off. So these are the things. And the best way to reach us is at, you go to www.nextarabia.com. Email is info@nextarabia.com.
Thank you so much, Ahmed, for coming on the show today. And it was really good catching up. And inshallah, we will see you soon in Kenya, hopefully. Or here in Saudi.
Looking forward.
Taka Talks. Exposing financial systems one story at a time.